This is an ABC podcast.
This is Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia. My name is Marianne Kupu, coming to you live from my home country, Nuku'alofa Tonga. I'm part of the Pacific Journalism Network, who've been hosting Pacific Beat each Friday in our very own countries. This is Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia. Coming up today, Tonga works to strengthen cybersecurity after its healthcare system was hacked. But are some functions best left offline?
I would strongly recommend Tonga, but also every country, including Australia, I often recommend this, that we try very hard not to have electric elections.
Also, Pacific leaders call on the US for more information about deportees. And the spotlight to refereeing as the Flying Fijians gear up to face Scotland following a controversial loss to the Wallabies. I'm Marianne Kupu. Thank you for tuning in. But first, Fiji has been captivated this week with the ceremony and significance of the return of the powerful Tiwhiri title after more than two decades. Ratu Devitamara, the son of the country's founding prime minister, has been installed as the High Chief of Lao in sacred ceremonies held on the remote islands of Nayao and Lagimba. It marks the return of a dynasty and the potential rise of a future political leader. ABC's Fiji's correspondent, Lithe Movono, has been on the ground in Lao this week and sent off this report.
In the quiet calm of the cool morning on the island of Lakemba, the first Lali brought the people of Lao to Tumbo village to mark the start of an ancient installation ritual last performed in 1969. Dignitaries from foreign embassies began the steady stream of guests, which included King Tupou VI and Queen Nanasipou'u of Tonga, and Maori Queen Te Arikinui Kuini Ngawai Honoitepo. A service where faith and tradition intersect formed the installation to bestow Ratu Tevitamara with two more titles to the Tuinayau he was given 2 days before, making him one of Fiji's highest traditional leaders. In a sermon delivered by Reverend Dr. Semisi Turangavo, the new chief was given a message of courage and trust in divine authority.
If God is in the helm of leadership, there's nothing to worry about. For you, sir, God has already anointed you. God is on your side, and there is nothing to worry about.
Archbishop of Suva and head of the Catholic Church, Peter Lloyd Chong, anointed Ratu Tevitamara with sacred oil of multiple Fijian fragrances made by women whose ancestors performed the task 56 years ago. Archbishop Chong says he hopes Ratu Tevita would take his cue from the symbolism of the installation ritual.
It's a time to reflect on how we can be better communicators of the Christian message by bringing together Christian symbols and the local symbols, you know, the Tiwhiri system, how it can help enhance, promote truth, justice, peace, and a more humanistic love.
The hundreds who gathered in Tumbo village watched as the Alofi, a council of Lao's highest chiefs, drank kava in a sacred ceremony of endorsement. The chiefly title of Tui Lao and Sao Nivanua on Lao, dormant for over 50 years, was revived and once again conferred upon Amara. Witnesses, including ambassadors and high commissioners, listened to Ratu Tevita's promise to lift Lao to prosperity as he encouraged the preservation and promotion of Fijian traditions.
Sa ikuendi na talenga nangau nongo, I take this opportunity to proclaim to you all that I commit to do my best in my life as your leader, to guide you to a direction where we all gain prosperity in unity, care, and happiness. I commit to exercising my best judgment in times of difference and when we face challenges, and to always consider both sides of the issue equally so that we remain in harmony and journey well together.
Ratutevita fled Fiji in 2011 after being accused of treason by then Prime Minister Frank Bainimarama. He re-emerged this week, crowned in the place of his father, Ratutsir Kamisese Mara, a powerful symbol that signals a return of the Mara dynasty. Some say it could be the quiet start of a political campaign. But here in Lau, many are simply proud. After decades of silence, their chiefly voice has returned.
That was Lithe Mabono with that report from the Lau Islands. To Tonga now, Tonga's government says it's strengthening its cybersecurity after the country's largest medical facility was hacked. The police minister says the hackers demanded a ransom to release confidential information they encrypted at the Viola Hospital last month. Cybersecurity experts dispatched by the Australian government have since decrypted and restored the system. But one expert says some government functions may be best left offline as a threat of cyber attack increase. Final Fonua reports.
I am considering
That was Tongan State Radio updating the public on investigations into a cyber attack on the country's main medical facility, Viola Hospital. In that broadcast, Tonga's Health Minister Ana Akaola said a team of Australian cybersecurity experts were assisting authorities. According to Minister for Police Biveni Biukala, the hackers had encrypted data in the hospital's information system, denying access unless a ransom of 1 million was paid.
The nature of the attack is such that they encrypting the database so that deny the normal system accessing to it and demand a ransom. But it's not in a way that they capture the whole data to be in their disposal to expose any personal details.
The cyber attack is a wake-up call for Tonga. Mr. Biukala said a key outcome of the investigation so far is strengthening Tonga's cyber security.
This is a lesson learned. The things that the Australian expertise have identified as weaknesses are now given to the major and Ministry of Health to work on regrouping and restructuring and re-strengthening those security dimensions.
Former head of Australia's lead agency for cybersecurity, Alastair McGibbon, says cybersecurity systems need to cover the very basics, such as identifying imposters who use stolen passwords.
So if you think about having a house that has bars on the windows and doors, but we hand the key over to a criminal, then it doesn't matter if we've got a good lock or bars on the windows because we've literally handed them the keys.
Mr. McGibbon says it's vital for countries with limited cyber defense capabilities to seek assistance from partners like Australia. He says hackers are numerous and elusive as they operate from the wilderness of the dark web.
The dark web is essentially the parts of the internet that people, when they're online, can't see. That is where criminals will do their business. So they will exchange information with each other in order to sell that to another criminal, or maybe they will buy access, like usernames and passwords, to computer systems from other criminals there on the dark web.
Another vital aspect of cybersecurity is the regular updating of software. Cybersecurity researcher from the University of New South Wales, Richard Buckland, says developing strong cybersecurity systems requires constant upgrades as cyber criminals are constantly adapting their ransomwares.
Cybersecurity has to constantly be updated and
probably you have to patch almost weekly. It's people that write software will publicly say everyone needs to apply this patch now as soon as a weakness is discovered. And so you need to have dedicated staff who are patching things. And also every country needs to have its own response. The quicker you can act and the better, the more capability you have locally, the more you can control how bad it is.
Mr. Buckland says all electronic systems are vulnerable to cyber attacks. It's a fact that's prompted him to publicly call on governments to avoid implementing any electronic systems for high-stake events like political elections. He says elections should stick to the old pen and paper.
I would strongly recommend Tonga, but also every country, including Australia, I often recommend this, that we try very hard not to have electronic elections. I don't know your current status in Tonga, but I'm hoping you're still having pencil and paper elections. They're still not perfect. And of course, people can be corrupt and some of the paper ballots can be changed. But the problem with electronic elections is all of the ballots can be changed.
That was the head of Australia's lead agency for cybersecurity, Alessa McGibbon.
Tune in this Saturday to catch the 2025 Pacific Break launch concert on ABC Radio Australia.
Recorded live in Apia, Samoa, the concert kicks off the search for the best original unsigned talent across the Pacific and Timor-Leste.
The show features some of the Pacific's biggest names like Mr. T, Danielle, Tofanga Meke, Ju Ben, Mr. Cowboy, and last year's Pacific Break winner Chris Rohomai from the Solomon Islands.
Turn up your radio and enjoy the Pacific Break launch concert Saturday from 11 a.m. PNG time on ABC Radio Australia.
You're listening to Pacific Beat. I'm Marianne Gopal. Welcome back. An immigration crackdown of undocumented migrants in U.S. cities has captivated the world in recent weeks, sparking fears a wave of deportees may be about to enter the Pacific. U.S. immigration documents have marked hundreds of Pacific migrants for deportation, most of which come from Fiji, Tonga, and the Marshall Islands. But as for how and when they'll be sent back remains anyone's guess. And now a push is underway for Pacific leaders to hold a panel with U.S. officials to get an idea of what to expect. Danielle Watson, an associate professor with the Queensland University of Technology School of Justice, is helping to lead that charge. And she held a dialogue with Pacific officials last week to hear their concerns.
Well, one of the main things you keep hearing is that there are concerns about individuals returning to Pacific Islands and how those returns constrain already limited resources. When you think about persons coming into the Pacific from the U.S. specifically, you're looking at individuals who spend decades in the U.S., often arriving in the U.S. as children and lacking cultural ties or support networks in the countries of origin. So this disconnect complicates reintegration efforts and basically leads to social and economic challenges that countries are preparing for.
And what kinds of people did you speak to during your trip?
Well, in terms of conversations around deportation specifically, we had conversations with the Commissioner of Police for Fiji and individuals from Tonga, National Security Advisor and so forth.
Now, we've seen a lot in recent weeks, you know, all the images on TV with the ICE raids, the immigration raids in places like LA, and just reports of lots of people being rounded up. Do Pacific leaders and stakeholders have an idea of how many deportees they're going to receive, or is it all still a bit up in the air?
I think it's up in the air, except for numbers that have already been made public. So if we look at what's out there in public forum, we're seeing numbers where Pacific nations have significant numbers of nationals facing deportation orders. For example, if you look at the Marshall Island Journal, there are numbers there to suggest Fiji should expect 353 individuals, Tonga 151, FSM 72, Samoa 57, and the list goes on.
In terms of time frames on when those countries can expect to receive them, do they have any clarity, or are they just sort of in this position of perpetual waiting?
I feel like it's a situation of perpetual waiting. I'm not aware of any confirmed dates of receipt of individuals coming into these countries.
And just based on the research you've done in the past and the things that you've said on our show before, what impacts would an influx of deportees have on countries in the Pacific?
Oh, if you look at Tonga, for example, which I've written a bit about, their reported difficulties managing return of deportees, particularly those with criminal backgrounds. And this leads to concerns about rising crime rates, the influence on organized drug networks. Similarly, the Marshall Islands and Micronesia faces challenges in terms of providing adequate support services to returning individuals. So there are these concerns around the criteria for exclusion from those countries to the Pacific. And again, the disconnect that complicates reintegration efforts when you have persons coming into countries where they have no familial ties, not familiar with the languages and all other similar social and cultural complications.
Now, there's been some speculation as well that some Pacific countries may be asked to take on, you know, other foreign deportees to avoid, you know, US travel bans and things like that. Tonga and Vanuatu, Tuvalu, found their way on a blacklist that was released about a month ago. Do you think that's something that would be realistic?
Well, if we look at the criteria for inclusion, based on what's out there in the public domain, it's reportedly involving concerns around passport security, identity documentation and cooperation in accepting deported nationals. But while the U.S. has the authority to impose such restrictions, the effectiveness of using travel ban as a leverage, of course, is very debatable. Pacific nations may comply, let's say, to maintain diplomatic relations and access to U.S. programs. But that doesn't change the underlying challenges of reintegration and resource limitations that remain significant obstacles for Pacific Island states.
And just finally, Danielle, we've spoken a little bit about Tonga's vulnerabilities, but obviously, you know, 351 or so listed for Fiji, quite a few in the Marshall Islands as well. What kind of capacity do those countries have to handle, a big influx of deportees?
I think Fiji, more than Marshall Island at this stage, is somewhat advanced in their preparation and engaging multiple non-state stakeholders to support reintegration efforts. At the same time, there is awareness in Marshall Islands, or at least some sense of a need for preparation. The mobility of non-state stakeholders is not obviously as advanced as efforts in Fiji, but I would imagine they're certainly on the way.
Danielle Watson, an associate professor with the Queensland University of Technology School of Justice, speaking with Carl Evans. Stick around, because up next we'll look at what's making headline around the Pacific.
Hold the front page!
Well, it's that time to take a look at what's making headlines around the Pacific. And to do that, I'm joined by producer Carl Evans. Carl, fifi hake.
Saipe malo, Marion. How are you today?
Cold. It's cold here in Tonga.
It's cold in Tonga. Oh, wow. If it's cold in Tonga, I don't know what that means for the rest of us. But I do want to say thank you very much for teaching me that little phrase of Tongan there. I can now safely add that to the very other few phrases I know, which is a little bit of French and a little bit of Italian. So thank you very much.
Yes. Well, let's get to it, Kyle. Well, we start in PNG, where it appears two men have died in the aftermath of Wednesday's State of the Region. What happened?
Yeah, it's quite a dark story, Marion, to kick things off. Police in PNG have reported two deaths in the same location at WRC Estate in Kadang. So a 30-year-old man from Central Hagen and a man in his 60s from Hela both died as a result of a fight that occurred in different locations within that estate. However, the nature of the deaths appear to be quite different. The 30-year-old man was found lying at the front gate of the estate on Thursday morning. Meanwhile, the other man was tragically sleeping in his house when a group alleged to be from Hela, who resided at a settlement near the estate, actually burned down his home with him inside. It was actually one of 20 homes lit aflame by that particular group, allegedly, and police say they have acted very swiftly to bring the situation under control, with one suspect has since been admitted to hospital and is under very close police supervision. In the meantime, they've urged families in the area as well as friends of the deceased to not take matters into their own hands.
That's very sad to hear, Kyle. But moving on, the number of New Zealanders moving to Australia have reached a new high. Now, is that right? Is that number right?
That is correct, Marion. It's the highest level in more than a decade. In fact, according to Stats New Zealand, which states that just under 30,000 Kiwis immigrated to Australia in 2024, making it the highest level since 2012, when it peaked at 44,000. Since that 2012 period, there's actually been a net loss of migration year on year to Australia, with the number getting as low as 3,000 a year between 2014 and 2019. It's obviously spiked a lot since then. Meanwhile, the stats also show that the number of migrants entering New Zealand has fallen to a 2.5-year low as well. There was a net gain of about 14,800 in the year that ended in May, compared to more than 84,000 the year before. Acting Prime Minister David Seymour, he has actually admitted as well that the number of people leaving to Australia was higher than they'd like. But he also says, look, it's not entirely the government's fault. It's more of a result of post-COVID inflation, post-COVID interest rates, which seems to be having an impact everywhere, Marion.
Yes, this is relatable to me because majority of my family in New Zealand have migrated to Australia, like almost all of them.
Yeah, very interesting.
But yes, let's go into sport. Samoa into the semifinals in the OFC Women's Nation Cup. Now, how did that play out?
Played out with a very impressive 3-1 win over Tahiti. Tahiti, which are typically a pretty strong soccer territory. So Samoa struck first off a penalty and then sealed the game with an absolute screamer of a goal from outside of the box. I've got a little bit of audio from that, so let's take a listen.
Malia Joseph once again. Oh, what a shot! She tried one earlier. Samoa qualified 3-1.
Yeah, so it really was a great goal. The audio probably doesn't do it justice in some ways, but they are through to the semi-final, as are PNG, who demolished the Cook Islands 8-0 yesterday in the other game that took place. So they've finished at the top of the table of Group A. Samoa are second to them. The other table will continue action today with Solomon Islands playing Tonga and Vanuatu playing Fiji. And I believe this is the last day of group play action before those semi-finals will start. And then there'll be a crossover between the two groups. So very much coming to the pointy end of the competition, Marion.
Wow, it's so good to see like all these Pacific Islands coming in and out of the best in what they do, especially with sports. Good luck to the Solomon playing against Tonga and also Vanuatu playing against Fiji. But thank you very much, Kyle, for bringing these stories here with Pacific Beat.
Not a problem at all, Marion.
Join me, Rick Howe, on Island Music for the finest in ska, rocksteady, roots, dub, sizzling dancehall, and all the hottest releases from around the Pacific.
Hi, I'm Ronnie Coreni from Sorong Samurai, and you're listening to Island Music.
My name is Tieni from Te Tangi o Te Kara, and you're listening to Island Music.
Join me, Rick Howe, on Island Music.
Saturdays, 12 p.m. PNG time on ABC Radio Australia.
Vanuatu's Prime Minister Jochen Abad has cancelled the country's annual Independence Ball, one of the highlights of the country's independence celebrations. Local media reports that the funds for the ball could be redirected to combating cervical cancer. The disease is preventable, but in Vanuatu, it's the second most common cancer among women. For the last 4 years, the University of New South Wales Kirby Institute has been working to get screening done across the country. and the Institute Asia and Pacific Health Senior Program Manager, Vanessa Price, told our reporter, Jordan Fennell, that new advances in science means women can now access same-day treatment.
Approximately 22 women diagnosed with cervical cancer per year, but it's likely that there are much higher numbers. Sadly, the majority of those women who are diagnosed will die, and that's usually due to late-stage diagnosis of the cancer. So this not only affects the women, but also children, families and communities who are losing these women really in the prime of their lives.
The Kirby Institute has been tackling the issue of cervical cancer in Vanuatu since 2021. Over the last 4 years, what has the money that you've been given and the programs you've been working on, what does that look like? What are you actually doing in Vanuatu?
So new advances in cervical screening, particularly the development of highly accurate tests that can be provided at the point of care on self-collected specimens, so specimens that women collect themselves, and also new treatment options that are effective and easy to use, mean that women can be offered same-day screening and treatment to prevent cervical cancer in real time, reducing the risk of progressive disease and saving those women's lives. And all of this is mobile. So this can be packed up and shipped or flown to communities in very remote places. And the Vanuatu team have really certainly used all modes of transport in taking this screening and treatment, including secondary treatments such as LETs to communities all across Vanuatu. So it's small teams on the ground that will be going out and conducting outreach, and they may use local health facilities and set up there, or they may go within communities to offer that screening for women.
When you mentioned same day screen and treatment, what does treatment look like?
So women are being screened using testing for HPV DNA, and it's looking for the types of HPV DNA that cause cervical cancer. So if a woman tests positive to having one of those types of HPV, then they will be offered visual inspection to check that they are eligible for treatment. And if they are, then they will be offered thermal ablation on the same day. So essentially, that is removing those precancerous cells from the cervix. So it's preventing the disease from progressing any further. Not all women will be able to have that treatment. Some may need to be referred for further gynecological review. But the majority of women who test positive are eligible for that treatment on the same day.
And how long does that process normally take on the day?
A very short time. So once you've self-collected your sample, that gets processed and put into the GeneXpert machine, you can have your results within an hour. If you do test positive, then as I said, it's a visual inspection first, so that is with a speculum exam. And if you are eligible for treatment, that treatment can be done straight away and takes about 90 seconds.
Wow. Oh, I didn't realize that. How fascinating. And what challenges does your team, the Kirby Institute's team, and local teams on the ground face in getting out to the women, screening, testing, and giving vaccines?
Vanuatu faces enormous challenges in terms of the geographic remoteness of their population being spread across 83 islands. And they've also experienced multiple natural disasters in the past few years, such as the twin cyclones in March 2023, and also the earthquake last year in December that impacted Port Vila. And human resources within the health workforce in Vanuatu are already really, really stretched. So they're often required to pivot to disaster response in these circumstances, which pauses the delivery of other services. However, it's really the health workers in Vanuatu that have created the success of the cervical cancer screening program. Their resilience, their dedication, and their leadership is really what has made the program a success in Vanuatu.
And finally, what message would you have for women in Vanuatu who might listen in to this, whether that's about seeking treatment or the help that's available? What message is that for them?
I think the most important messages are that almost all cases of cervical cancer are due to HPV infection. And unfortunately, the majority of women with HPV infection or early cervical disease won't experience any symptoms, making screening essential to detect that disease early so it can be prevented in its progression. So cervical cancer is preventable. You can protect your girls by getting them vaccinated with the HPV vaccine, and you can protect yourself by undergoing cervical screening. It's free, it's painless, you can collect your own sample, and you can have your results and treatment if it's needed in the same day. So no one should be dying from cervical cancer.
That was the Kirby Institute, Vanessa Price, speaking there. Stay locked here with Pacific Beat because coming up next, we're going to turn to sport. Turning to sports now, in the eyes of most of their fans, the Flying Fijians were robbed of victory over Australia last weekend when a controversial refereeing decision let the Wallabies off the hook at a crucial stage of the match. So expect head coach Mike Burns' team to be fired up when they'll take on Scotland on home soil in Suva tomorrow. Meanwhile, the chair of Fiji Rugby, John Sunday, has conceded that there is concern among the leading Pacific nations over the huge sum of money flowing into rugby league from the Australian government. However, Sunday says that does not mean his union will be turning to China for financial assistance. And right now, a more immediate concern is to avoid a repeat of last weekend's refereeing controversy against the Scots.
You know, speaking to Coach Mick Burns, we've let him and the team leadership group handle that, and I think they've sought clarification. But even during the game, sitting up in the stands, sitting with the chairman of World Rugby, there's comments coming from people around, you know, what would World Rugby going to do about it? All of this kind of stuff is killing the game. So, you know, it's something that I bet World Rugby will need to look at more deeply. What we can do with our rights and our obligations for questioning the referee and questioning authority, that's already happening. But the boys have focused on controlling what they can do better and how they can better organise themselves to win the game. And so that's in the focus, and I think they'll get over.
The Scots, I gather, might have a few injury problems, which clearly won't help them. But for most of their players, playing in Fijian conditions is going to be a very new experience. And that's tough, isn't it? I mean, we've seen that in Super Rugby, and they don't have to travel so far.
Well, that's right, yes. I mean, the conditions are completely different from what they're used to normally. But Scotland is a very competitive side, and we're taking them very seriously. To beat the Maori All Blacks on tour is in itself a great achievement, so we respect that.
From what I've been seeing on social media and the like, I mean, the team have been out and about, making their presence absolutely known in the community, visiting schools. These matches now have become big social occasions, haven't they? And it will be nice to see more of them.
All touring teams that come, we try to encourage them to visit schools and see the impact, and then just also visit school kids playing and training rugby, both girls and boys, and just to interact with the community. It's our way of teaching school kids the values of rugby and about respect, but also showing them that there's also a pathway that they might want to choose to, you know, to see the world and be part of the Flying Fijian or Fijiana team that play in these big matches. So it's a great occasion. From my reports, I think the Scots thoroughly enjoyed the visit with the schools, and it's great. It's the beauty about rugby union. We connect with the community and continue to build the dream.
Can I ask on a related subject in the Australian press this week, talking about the money that's going into rugby league from the Australian government, and they're suggesting there are concerns in the Pacific, they're missing out, and they're looking to China. Well, we know that Fiji already has a memorandum of understanding with the Chinese rugby union. What do you think about this? Is this a definite shift by the Pacific teams to look for help financially from China, or is it just coincidence?
Well, it's a current issue of significance. I mean, from Fiji's perspective, our memorandum of understanding with China has been sitting in the in-tray for the last 5 years. This is not something that came overnight, but they've been asking us to work with Fiji Rugby to help develop their competition, their players. I can say that there's several Fijian coaches and players that are in China at the moment, so it's a win-win, and I think it's good. But whether we are using that to ask for financial assistance is not something that we're looking at. It's really really just in the spirit of rugby. But yes, in relation to the financial injection into rugby league, that's going to be a huge threat to the game in the Pacific. Fiji, Tonga and Samoa. In Fiji, rugby union is a bit more entrenched in part of the DNA, but you know, we can't just rest on that. We've got to continue to look at how are the threats, and rugby league is always going to be a big threat, particularly with the kind of big money that, you know, the federal government is throwing at them. It is a very real threat, and it's something that we're looking at and taking very seriously.
But Australian government money has come your way, hasn't it? Fijiana have benefited, yeah. And both the men's and women's teams in Super Rugby, the two Drua teams have benefited as well. So it seems to me there is room for negotiation here. I mean, it might not be on the scale of what's happened in PNG, for example, but there they're launching a whole new franchise over 10 years, so that was always going to cost more.
100%. I mean, look, we're always thankful to the taxpayers of Australia and the government for all the assistance for setting up of the Drua franchise, which has been an out-and-out success, and the majority of the current flying Fijian squad are from the Drua franchise, which shows the impact that that funding has had. The return on investment has been huge. So we're always thankful for that. We could do with more, but what has been given has been plenty. But we're currently talking to Tonga, Samoa and Rugby Australia to see how we can maybe approach the federal government in a much more structured and much more sensible way on this, and see whether there is a way we could all benefit from the largesse of the Australian government and the Australian taxpayer. That's the spirit and the Vuvale partnership. It all adds up to a great relationship.
Do you happen to know if Prime Minister Rambuka had a word in the ear of Prime Minister Albanese during the match last weekend when Australia took on Fiji?
I'm sure he did, but I wasn't privy to that. But myself, to the Rugby Australia officials, yes, I did mention to them to see how we can coordinate to manage this issue better in the interest of rugby union.
That's John Sunday, chair of Fiji Rugby, who says the weather has been good in Suva this week and all the right ingredients are there for a great game against the Scot tomorrow. And John was talking to Richard Ewood. And as a curtain raiser, the Fiji Military Force team will be taking on the British Army team in what is likely to be another fierce battle, you would think. Still staying with sport, the biggest sporting event in Palau's history ended with the closing ceremony at the Pacific Mini Games 2 nights ago. The final medal count saw Tahiti way out in front with 72 golds, nearly 3 times more than Fiji in second place, while the host nation finished inside the top 10 with 5 golds and a very credible 29 medals in all. Champion the athlete and former senior coach in Fiji, Albert Miller, who acted as a consultant to the host nation, says the large amount of government investment from Paris makes the two French territories hard to match. But he says the mini games have left an important legacy for Palau, and although his young track and field team registered just a solitary bronze medal this time, there is talent there that can be nurtured.
You know, we had a very small team. We had 4 girls and about 10 boys, and the majority of them were high school age, you know, 14, 15. So that sort of gives you an indication of where we were before the game started. But all in all, I think going into the games, I spoke to the athletes and encouraged them just to enjoy the experience. But I think coming out of it, they had a positive reaction to their competitions. And, you know, I told them, hey, part of the struggle is competing and setting a standard for yourselves and then, work from there. So I think all in all, they had a very positive experience, despite the fact that, we were outclassed in most of the events that we took part in. And it has been a big learning experience for all the athletes in Palau.
The team as a whole, 29 medals, 5 of them gold, they finished 9th on the final standings. But for your group of athletes, did they feel they were part of that, even though they weren't able to contribute in terms of getting on the podium?
I think they enjoyed the opportunity that they were given to represent Palau, and they did it to the best of their abilities, knowing that most of them were doing certain events for the first time in a major regional competition. In that regards, I'm hoping that they've enjoyed the experience to the point where they'll stick around and try and get better in years to come.
I suppose that's the question, though, isn't it? Where do they go next? The games are over now. Clearly, things are going to die down a little in Palau. It would be very easy, you would think, to go backwards without the kind of assistance, for example, that you've been able to provide. So how do they maintain momentum in terms of track and field in Palau?
Well, I did have a brief discussion with the president of Palau Athletics, and basically standing in front of the track, and I said, hey, this is the envy of the region. Most countries in the Pacific don't have what you guys have right now. So the challenge for Palau moving forward is getting more bodies out at the track and coming up with some recommendations. And one of the recommendations is to establish clubs besides certifying more coaches in the more technical events. And I think once we do that and they get the clubs running, and one thing that I found out coming to Palau, the competitions was far and few in between. So, you know, it's one thing to train every day in, day out. If there's no competitions, really no measurement of your fitness or, you know, which direction you're going. So hopefully they'll take on board some of my recommendations, and down the road they'll just have more athletes, both male and female, training at the track.
What about the games as a whole? What has the games experience been like for you, being there in the build-up and throughout the whole process right up to the closing ceremony? How would you describe the Palau mini games experience to someone who wasn't there?
I've been going to regional games since 83, and each game, you know, has its own unique features. Palau experience has been, it's the local organizing committee really went out of their way to make sure that the facilities were, you know, 100% ready, and they did that. Unfortunately, the weather was not favorable throughout the 2 weeks, but all in all, I think all the different countries and athletes enjoyed using the new facilities. So, you know, speaking to the chairman of the local organizing committee, I said, man, you've left a wonderful legacy for Palau, and, you know, hopefully they'll be able to carry that through and improve on most of the sports in the next regional games.
What are your thoughts on the final medal table? Tahiti were so far out in front, an enormous gap between the medals that they won and everybody else. Team Fiji finishing second, Team Samoa in third, Palau were in ninth. Can you explain the gap? Why Tahiti was so superior? Was it a case that they sent more senior athletes, for example, to the games?
I think they knew where their strengths were in swimming and most of the other individual sports. I think in swimming alone, they won almost 30 medals or something. And I think credit goes to the French government, knowing that New Caledonia wasn't going to be in full force. And I'm guessing that they diverted most of their resources to Tahiti, making sure that, the French territories are still number one in the region.
But the gap between Tahiti and New Caledonia when they're there, it's established, really, isn't it? It's been that way for the longest time. Fiji have had their moments. Papua New Guinea have had their moments. But generally speaking, it's those two that have dominated from the start of the Pacific Games and the mini games.
I think they've been very fortunate to get the backing of the French government, because most of them, once they identified as having some kind of athletic potential, you know, right away they're sent to France, and you know, they get into schools and they get into specialized training programs, basically preparing them for the next either mini games or Pacific Games. Hopefully, you know, other Pacific Island countries will, you know, learn a lesson from the French territories and start investing in sports that'll get them medals.
Albert Miller reflecting on the legacy of the Palau Mini Games and what it will take for other Pacific nations to overhaul the might of the French in the future. And Albert was talking to Richard Ewood. And that brings us to the end of Pacific Beat. Recapping our top story, Fiji celebrates the return of a powerful chiefly title as Ratu Levitamara, the son of the country's founding prime minister, is installed as High Chief of Lao.
If God is in the helm of leadership, there's nothing to worry about. For you, sir, God has already anointed you. God is on your side, and there is nothing to worry about.
We'll be back at the same time tomorrow, Monday. On Monday, that's at 6 a.m. PNG time. I'm Miriam Kupo from Nukualofa Intonga. Malopito mo me amai, kamo me a tuafatu.
Salo Falava. I'm Afamasanga Seyuli Salamasina Von Reiki, and I'm inviting you to join me on a journey through the evolution of our Pacific cultures on Culture Compass. We'll meet incredible people dedicated to preserving traditions while adapting them for today's world. Join me as we travel the Pacific to celebrate our resilience, revival, and deep-rooted connection.
Search for Culture Compass wherever you get your podcasts to listen.